Rabbinic Judaism also diverges in very important ways, and in many ways it's actually a parallel process. At the same time, the same types of decisions are made in Rabbinic Judaism as were made in Christianity. For example, both sides, just to compress history, but in the course of the 2nd to 4th centuries, both sides decide to exclude the Jewish believers in Jesus or in Yeshua. So the Christians say that you cannot continue to be Jewish. The Gentile Christians say you cannot continue to be Jewish, and if you believe in Yeshua, and the Rabbinic Jews say you cannot continue to be Jewish if you believe in Yeshua. On the Jewish side, the decision is made in the 2nd century by the remnants of the Pharisees, or the surviving Pharisaical group, that all of Israel has to listen to the voice of the rabbis and submit to the council of rabbis. Now, this process of subjugating the various synagogues of the entire Roman Empire to the rabbis took place over centuries. It was not accomplished until probably the 5th century, some people say the 6th century or the 7th century. But this decision was made in what became Rabbinic Judaism, that people are not free just to decide what God is telling them, but rather they have to submit to the decree of the rabbis about what they should do. And the exact same decision around the same time is made in Christianity as well. Constantine, after the Council of Nicaea, wrote to all the churches, and he said, the voice of the bishops is to be regarded as the voice of God. In other words, you don't have freedom of conscience on anything that the bishops have decided in council, the church hierarchy had decided. So in both Rabbinic Judaism and in Christianity, there's a specific decision made to establish that sort of human authority that later in the scientific revolution and perhaps today in a messianic revolution, we're trying to revise to some extent.
Yeah, but, you know, while we're looking back at it, we see, you know, that, you know, what happened was error. But if we were to put ourselves in their time, they were trying to defend themselves against all sort of errors in the church at that time, like Gnosticism and stuff, so that they had to have some kind of authority.
We could argue about that. I mean, does anyone happen to know the reason for which the first great church council, the Council of Nicaea, was called? There were a few different issues that were discussed, but there was, but in the sources, there's one particular issue that caused the council to be called. It actually wasn't that. That was one of the issues that was discussed there. The Arian controversy, exactly. But I think you were starting to say it, Fred.
Baptism?
No, not baptism.
Oh. But that's what divided the Greek church from the Roman church.
It was not resurrection, it was not baptism.
Was it maintaining Jewish traditions?
Yes, it was. It was something even more specific than that, but that's what it was. No, it wasn't circumcision. It was something. It was something called Pascha.
Oh, Pascha.
Changing the date.
Which unfortunately we can't really translate into English because we have two completely different translations for it. Because of the decision of the Council of Nicaea, we have two completely different interpretations: Passover and Easter. Now, because of this, in sources that I give my students sometimes in class, we get these really strange translations, like the controversy over the Christian Passover, or the debate over Jewish Easter customs, because it arose from this period. And the reason that the Council of Nicaea was called, according to the account of Eusebius, is that some Christians were celebrating Pascha according to the Jewish custom,
and some Christians were celebrating it on a different day. And this seems so disconcerting to people. How could some people celebrate it on one day and some other people celebrate it on another day? And so they called it a great council to determine the question. And the decision was made, in Constantine's words, paraphrasing a little bit, but it said several times in the documents, let us then have nothing to do with the murderous rabble of the Jews. Let us not follow any of their customs, for we have received from our Savior a better way. And this is the birth of Christianity, official Christianity. The Council of Nicaea, which is predicated on the principle that Christianity must have nothing to do with Jews or Jewish customs. That is the seed from which, what we can describe as official Christianity begins. Now, please keep in mind, when I talk about Christianity in that sense, I'm not talking about belief in Jesus. I'm not talking about belief in Yeshua. I'm talking about the religious system that was organized at that time and which persisted for centuries and which still has many remnants today in the various churches.
When was this?
325. Nicaea.
And Trent was like 4-something?
Well, I think there are two different councils of Trent. There's one council of Trent during the Reformation, which is like 1555. There may have been an earlier one. I'm not sure of the date.
Why didn't they come up, because I know in France, Easter does come from that. Why didn't they come up with something totally different? I mean, like, we have Easter. Why does in France they still even have that? You think they would just have
because,
nothing to do with it?
What?
That name, why
did
they
because,
have totally separated
yeah,
from...
Yeah, because, again, it's, there was... In Greek, it's Pascha. I don't know exactly what it is in Latin.
Okay.
But so it's so close.
They've taken it, they translated it from the Hebrew into the Greek.
Most languages still have just one word.
Yeah.
It's English.
Pascha
exactly. Yeah, and so, for example, in most... What's that?
Pasquale.
Right, in most languages, if you want to talk about Passover, you say basically the Jewish Passover.
Okay.
And if you just say Passover, Pach, or Pascha, or something like that, it means Easter. Because Christianity came to dominate. So again, this is the system that's being discussed in the book. Now, of course, we could say, well, there was the Reformation, and then there's evangelical Christianity today, which is different. It's true. It's true, and they're very different, and they're more accurate in certain respects. But what's being claimed in this book is that, in some way, they're all like this. You know, they're getting more accurate because they're adding on epicycles and deference and so forth, but they're not changing the fundamental system and the fundamental assumptions of the system. And that we'll be much better off if we think about what the fundamental assumptions of the system are and come to a simpler understanding. Does that make sense? How are we doing for time, by the way? All right, okay. Well, no one's falling asleep, at least.
Father's also making is that the system lasted so long because it seemed like there was only a few minor exceptions to it.
Right.
The planet.
Yeah.
That it's going along fine except for these few things.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Jews, definitely in numbers, they're smaller. And so you can say, well, you just put that aside, the system works.
Right. I think that's a really good point.
I think also you got to look at the people who maybe would have looked at it and kind of thought, like, hey, this isn't working. Even Copernicus, he had, his reservations were so strong that he waited until his deathbed to publish that because he said his fear of how they're going to take it. And so there could have been more people who might have questioned it, but they very likely could have just kept quiet because they knew this was going to make me a target the minute I opened my mouth.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
We've got to keep in mind that this is the 400 years after the invention of the printing press and the Reformation, people starting to read the word for themselves if they had enough money to buy a printed book. You know, I mean, they were starting to question what the Pope did, you know, and how the church thought, you know.
Yeah, and there were several times in Catholic history when there were attempts to question certain aspects of what was being done. The Reformation is the best known example, but there were others as well, earlier and later. But even the Reformation, of course, doesn't challenge the system of Christianity per se, what I would call institutional Christianity or official Christianity. And in fact, Luther didn't intend to start a revolution or a Reformation.
Neither did Copernicus. Neither did Copernicus. Reform their thinking.
Yeah. Now, it just so happened that probably because the church was so dead set against Copernican ideas and because of other changes in society, that it did actually produce this breakthrough. And the same thing with Luther. The church was so dead set against the modifications that he wanted to introduce that it became this huge, revolution, really, or reformation. But there have been, you know, attempts to revise. However, none of the Christian theologies deal with the basic assumptions that are laid down at Nicaea or revise those basic assumptions. And because, let's say, Messianic Judaism, and here's the relevance for us, because Messianic Judaism is to a certain extent influenced by the Christian world, a lot of these assumptions still influence our congregations as well. Maybe I'll just skip ahead a little bit. I wasn't going to do this, but just because we're sort of dancing around the point a little bit, I'll move to the end of the chapter, and we can come back to some other things that are before that. But I'll start reading at the very bottom of page 13. Will the conceptual shift to the true center make a difference in real life? It will change everything. No one in the time of Copernicus could have imagined the consequences of shifting the cosmological center of the universe. To some it was blasphemy, to others it was impudent. To most it must have seemed that the only aberration that needed to be explained lay in the thought processes of Copernicus. In other words, why couldn't he just believe what everyone else believed? What is his problem?
Mm-hmm.
And it must have seemed quite unrelated to how people live their lives day to day. I mean, what difference does it really make if the sun goes around the earth, if the earth goes around the sun? But they were wrong, all of them. This conceptual shift, in other words, with regard to understanding the Bible, will lead to a transformation of the world which will far exceed that brought by the Copernican Revolution. That's quite a claim. If the Copernican Revolution is one of the most significant events in world history, even according to completely secular scholars, it will bring this world out of the brokenness, sickness, and death in which it now lies into the wholeness, freedom, and vitality of the realized kingdom of God. It will change the nature of life itself, and that is ever so much more than a succession of new technological ages. Does anyone understand this preposterous claim that's being made by this crazy author here?
And the acorn doesn't fall apart from the
I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
What is the fundamental problem with the Jews according to the church? Like, okay, they're wandering, they still exist.
Right.
Why is that a problem? I mean, I'm sure. Is it the lack of belief in Yeshua, or is it something else?
It is partly that. In traditional Christian understanding of the Jewish people, the idea developed that the Jews rejected Christ, which is an allegation that's addressed in one of the later chapters here, actually. This is a common statement to find repeated, not only in Christian settings, but in Messianic settings. You constantly hear about the Jewish people rejecting the Messiah. Now, the later chapter that deals with that issue actually arose because I was at a particular congregation and happened to hear this, and I ended up doing a study on it. And the results of that study are in the chapter. So we'll get to that later. But the typical Christian perspective is that the Jews rejected Christ, therefore they were rejected by God. Now, this is a very key statement for understanding Christianity, Christian history, and the problem, and the question that you're asking, the problem that Christians had with the Jews. Because it's a statement that is completely contradictory to all of the promises of God in the Bible to the Jewish people, that he would never forsake them, and that he would never leave them. So they had to create epicycles and deference. How did they explain this? Well, those passages weren't actually talking about the Jews. They were talking about the church. They were talking about Christians. The Jews actually had been cast off by God. There was no longer any need for them. All of the glorious promises that God had promised to Israel now just pertain to the church. So the fact that the Jews didn't simply go away was in itself a problem, because it meant that there was a possibility that that interpretation was wrong, that God still was protecting the Jewish people, that God still was going to fulfill his promises. And so, for example, in the Middle Ages, one of the things that Christians, Christian beliefs, let's say, and there were many kind Christians in these periods who loved Jews as well, but the predominant strain was hatred, we could say, towards Jews. So they would summon Jews to debate about the Bible, in which Jews were forced to lose. They were not allowed to actually present any arguments that could conquer Christian arguments. So these were to show intentionally the superiority of Christianity over the existence of the Jews.
And also, kind of what Galileo was saying about people who were standing up against without reading.
Anti-Semitism is that God would prosper Jews in the Christian countries, in the, you know, economically, and then the Christians would feel threatened.
Again, because that fit into the system whereby Jews were, first of all, not supposed to really exist anymore, because they had served their purpose, they had been rejected by God. And if they had a purpose in existing, it was only to be the sign of having been rejected by God. In other words, to be this wandering Jew who would always be poor, who would always be oppressed and afflicted because Israel had rejected Christ. And so, like Fred is saying, if Jews prospered, it was a challenge for that whole ideology. That was one of the reasons why the Christian rulers were actually supposed to keep Jews intentionally in a subordinate position to try to prove this ideology correct. It wasn't correct. And, in fact, many of the greatest developments in Western civilization came partly through the Jewish world. For example, you would not have had the Copernican Revolution if not for Jewish scholars, who translated Greek texts, ancient Greek texts, from Arabic into Latin, so that they could be discovered by Christians. Because most of the texts of ancient Greek antiquity were not discovered until the Renaissance in Western Europe. Western Europe was quite backward in terms of civilization, if you want to compare these things, until that point in time. And the way that additional texts from Greek civilization came to the West during the time of the Renaissance was that they had been preserved in libraries that were now under Arabic control due to the Muslim conquest. And some Muslim scholars became interested in studying these ancient Greek texts, and they translated them into Arabic, and they wrote commentaries on them. And at this time, 90% of Jews or so lived in the Arabic world, and they spoke Judeo-Arabic. This is the language of Maimonides, a combination between Jewish and Arabic. And so these Jews were able to interact with the Arabs who were studying ancient Greek texts, and Jews eventually translated them into Latin for the West. And why do I say the Copernican Revolution wouldn't have happened? Well, it's a general point because, you know, the environment created by the rediscovery of those texts led partly to the study of Copernicus, but also because Copernicus, he already was troubled by the Ptolemaic system. There were two systems, the system of Ptolemy and Aristotle. It's sort of a combination of these two ancient Greek thinkers, what they believed the Earth was like, a system of concentric spheres centered on the Earth. So he was troubled by this system. He didn't know the alternative, and he discovered in ancient Greek texts that there were other Greek scientists who didn't hold to this view, who lived almost 2,000 years before he did. And actually, someone can read that quote, something else we're going to get to later. But this is the quote by Marshall Plagan that begins, "Aristarchus." Any volunteers? Okay, go for it, Jackie.
"Aristarchus appears to have arrived at the basic assumptions of the Copernican system almost 2,000 years earlier than Copernicus. Aristarchus's original account of the system is lost, but Archimedes, who is only one generation removed from him, described the system briefly in Sandrecaner. Plutarch tells us of a religious objection to the theory of Aristarchus. He notes that a certain Cleanthes, sometime around 232 BC, had charged Aristarchus with impiety for, quote, putting in motion the heart of the universe."
Yeah. So actually, long before Christianity existed, people could be charged with heresy for the idea that the earth revolved around the sun, and not vice versa, which is what Aristarchus actually discovered, or what he claimed. So in a sense, again, it didn't even have anything to do with Christianity or the Bible, this condemnation of challenges to the Ptolemaic or Aristotelian model. Like I said before, at the time that Copernicus and Galileo were advancing their discoveries, the opposition to them was phrased in biblical terminology, but the things that people were objecting to were not really from the Bible. They were ideas from Aristotle, who had become incorporated into the Christian system. So Copernicus actually became aware of this alternate ancient Greek interpretation of the universe or the solar system. As it says, almost 2,000 years earlier than Copernicus, it's described by Archimedes, who you may remember is the guy who was given a difficult problem to solve by a king. It had to do with a gold crown and determining whether it was pure gold or not. So what did he do?
He
went to the baths, thinking about it, and as soon as he lowered himself into the bath, he jumped up and screamed, "Eureka!" and ran naked through the streets back to his home. Eureka means "I found it." And what he had discovered is the principle of displacement in water relative to the density of an object. So that's just a side note, of course. He also invented a lot of other things. But
According to Archimedes, Aristarchus actually believed that the sun was at the center of the solar system and the earth revolved around it. And this gave Copernicus stimulus for his own ideas. And just to finish the point, the same thing is true here. In other words, what my dad is going to propose is not that there's some new model that can be invented. Copernicus didn't actually invent a new model. But rather that if we go back to the ancient model, to the way it's described in the true text, then we can have a better and a simpler understanding. If we're willing to let go of preconceptions and ideologies that have accumulated in the meantime. Okay, Ellen.
My eyes just popped a little bit when you mentioned that Aristotle had somehow been incorporated into the Christian thinking.
I will say a couple things briefly. The first is that in early Gentile Christianity, as early as the second century, there was a debate, a very significant and extensive debate that continued for a long time about what people called the pagan philosophers. And this is part of the story, again, of how by the 4th century, when Christianity actually crystallized, and I don't know if you caught the point that I was making before, but if you go to a Catholic website, or the Catholic Encyclopedia, for example, which is online, and you look up the Doctors of the Church, these are the most important formulators of Christian theology, according to Catholicism. You will find something very interesting. There are 8 of them, and 7 out of the 8 are from the 4th century. That tells you something about Catholic theology and when it was formulated and what the context was for how it was formulated. But so, how do we get from 1st century Israel, which is a completely different conceptual world from, you know, pagan Rome in the 4th century, how did, you know, such a deep gap develop when Christianity claimed to be based on the Bible and on the teachings of a Jew who lived in Israel? Well, this is part of the story. In the 2nd century and beyond, as I mentioned, the debate about the pagan philosophers was a debate about pre-Christian Greek thinkers like Plato and Aristotle, more Plato in this time period, but how they should be viewed by a Christian. There were 2 options that were given, basically. Maybe neither of them were entirely correct. One option that was advanced, and I don't remember at the moment who was on which side, but in the 2nd century, the names that are most associated with this debate are Clement of Alexandria, and Tertullian. Should I hazard a guess as to who's on which side? Maybe I'll leave it for you to look at, because I'm really not sure at the moment. But one of them advanced the idea that the key point about the pagan philosophers was that they were pagan. In other words, they were polytheists, they did not have the revelation of God, and their philosophy, in other words, their investigation of wisdom, would lead people away from truth. It would lead people into heresy. Now, keep in mind that when you read the word philosophy or philosopher all the way up through until modern times, until the creation of all the different modern disciplines that are partly a result of the scientific revolution, the Copernican revolution, it doesn't mean what we think of as philosophy. It just is a Greek word meaning a lover of wisdom. So it refers to thinkers of any kind, really, or investigators of any kind. Aristotle's works encompass ethics, politics, biology, economics, and so forth. So, all the different spheres of knowledge, in other words. And the argument that was being made was that the works of these Greek thinkers could only lead to heresy. In other words, they had to be completely condemned by Christians, not read, not consulted, not studied. That was one option. The other option was the other extreme, which is curious in its own right. And this was the idea that the so-called pagan philosophers or Greek thinkers had actually had their own special revelation from God. that there was a Greek revelation that God had somehow, despite the fact that they didn't know the Bible, God had given them some sort of wisdom in the way that he had given the Jews his law. And that therefore, actually these could be incorporated into the Christian life, understanding, and so forth. And this is the idea that went out. The idea in the earlier days. The idea that the pagan philosophers could actually be incorporated into Christianity. That's the first thing I was going to say. Yeah.
But what is, I mean, they didn't just get incorporated, they took over. I mean, because like
yes.
the Bible had to fit into the Greek, really. It wasn't so much that the Greek had to fit into the Bible.
Right.
They, you know.
Yes. Now, fast forward a little bit. The Council of Nicaea and the development of Roman Christianity from that point on attempts to remove everything Jewish from the Bible. Just think about that for a minute. The Bible is entirely Jewish.
Yeah.
So the attempt of Christianity is to remove everything Jewish out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to end up with? Well, what they came up with was a combination of pre-existing paganism, which was the previous official religion of the Roman Empire. So you may have heard this phrase, Pontifex Maximus. Does anyone have any guess on where it originated? Or what it means?
Pope.
It's the word for the Pope now. But it was the title that was held by the pagan Roman emperor prior to the adoption of Christianity. The chief priest of paganism. And he simply transferred from the chief priest of paganism to the chief priest of a new religion that incorporated elements.
Well, Pontus is a Latin word, I think, for bridge, isn't it? And he bridged, he's like, God, he bridged the divine with the, in your way of thinking with humanity.
Okay, I can't say one way or the other.
Yeah, every time the Romans built a bridge, it was like an act of, religion, it's worshipped.
Yeah, sounds good. But there was this transition from the pagan Roman world suddenly to the Christian Roman world. Again, we're kind of going a little far from the topic, and there are lots and lots of issues here to deal with, but the Roman Empire did not stop persecuting Christianity, Gentile Christianity included, until the 4th century. It was an officially pagan empire. And one of the greatest persecutions of Gentile Christians took place at the end of the 3rd century. So in the reign of Diocletian. So it was not as though the Roman Empire had become Christian or had begun to believe in Yeshua, let's say, close to the time when Yeshua was living in Israel. That wasn't what happened at all. In fact, after Yeshua, the Romans fought a series of extremely bloody wars against the Jews, and for which they hated the Jews, because it cost the Roman Empire quite a bit. This is why the Jews were then expelled from Judea, and the land was renamed Palestine, and so forth. And while this is all going on, Gentile Christianity is developing on its own in various parts of the Roman Empire under persecution from that same empire. Until Constantine suddenly decides that he's going to convert to Christianity and create this new system, this new religion. There wasn't a system for the Roman Empire of Christianity before that. So, where are we in this story? You have these types of ideas going on within Gentile Christianity while it's still being persecuted. It's still developing in its own way, but it's not yet part of the Roman Empire. Fast forward to when it becomes part of the Roman Empire, suddenly in the 4th century, you have the combination of Roman ideas with previous practices of imperial rule, which included, you know, standard festivals and so forth. All these things are incorporated into the new Christianity. Then we jump forward to when your question was about Kyra, you know, how could it be that Aristotle was so important? It's because of this decision, the idea that, you know, the Greek thinkers would be acceptable and could be incorporated, that prepared the way. But then when the Greek text, especially of Aristotle, became more available in the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries to Christian thinkers, therefore they had a reason to search through those texts and to see what they could do. And actually, in all three of the major religions at this time, in the Mediterranean and European sphere, in Islam, in Christianity, and in Judaism, you had the same process that took place. You had a re-examination of the religious tradition juxtaposed with the Greek philosophical tradition. And in all three religions, people attempted to combine what they viewed as the Greek rational tradition with their own religious tradition. Best example for Judaism is Maimonides. And, you know, around approximately the same time, for Christianity, Thomas Aquinas. So it's this combination of Greek rationalism and the religious tradition that becomes the new orthodoxy. And so Aristotelian ideas were actually built into official theology by the time of Copernicus. I mean, there's no objective reason why any Christian church should prefer the Ptolemaic astronomical model to the, you know, Copernican astronomical model. What in the world does that have to do with Christianity? But Christianity was not just a belief in salvation as we might describe it, or as Christians might describe it today. It was an all-encompassing political and religious system that dominated every sphere of life. And the key element of that system, as you saw, was control. So you can't challenge the authority that is set up in any of these different spheres, because that really calls it into question in other spheres.
Well, the control was that the religious leaders were also in control of the land and the people and the political stuff as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's a unitary system. There's no division between religion and politics. There's no separation of church and state. Even though in Western Europe there is a separation between the papacy and the actual states, but there's no division between the world of religion and the world of politics. That comes much later. It's all together. And, you know, you've heard that saying, power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely. If the system of Christianity that developed around this time was integrally tied into political and religious power. And that's why it was so hard for someone like Copernicus even to say, I think that the way we look at the stars is wrong. Now, it's a little more than I was expecting to do on, you know, all of these historical issues, but I hope if you have questions or comments or something isn't clear, or it's not clear how this relates to what we were talking about before, that you'll ask them. So that
Thanks
we don't.
For going over.
What's that?
Thank you for going over.
Okay.
all right. Where were we actually? I'm not sure. what I was going to say next was number five on your outline. How do we move then to a better understanding? And the first thing that's necessary moving to a better understanding is to recognize that there's a problem. Is there a problem? Let's consider that. We understand the analogy that's being made now. We understand that this author is making the argument that there is some sort of problem. But now we have to consider whether there really is a problem or not. And if so, then we can think about how to fix it. Now, I'm not going to give a comprehensive investigation of that question of whether there's a problem or not right now, but I'm just going to mention a couple things very briefly to show that there are some strange ideas floating around in the world about God's Word and about Yeshua, for example. And one of these is quoted on page 11 of the book. It's one of the most famous fathers of the church, John Chrysostom, who preached, "The Jews say that they hope to see their city restored. No, they are mistaken. The temple will never rise again, nor the Jews return to their former polity. He whom you crucified did afterwards pull down your city, scatter your people, and disperse your nation throughout the whole world." So again, this is the general and continually repeated Christian perspective towards the Jews. You might not know this if you grew up in a Christian environment, but Christians were obsessed with Jews all throughout the Middle Ages and beyond because of these types of issues. They were absolutely obsessed with Jews, and they couldn't stop talking about them in this type of terminology. What he's saying is the Jews have been forever rejected by God. Never again will Jerusalem be restored. Never again will the Jews come back to the land. Martin Luther says basically the same thing. So it goes on through the Reformation as well. And that's a key component of this ideology. Now, most of us, sitting from where we are today, would say, no, that's a wrong interpretation of Scripture. We can also say, you know what, it's false, because Jerusalem has been rebuilt and Jews are living in the land. But most of us now would say, with that advantage of hindsight, you know, that's a bad interpretation of Scripture. But what would we have thought if we were in that society and being taught this continually? That's the point about the system. The system teaches you, and you grow up in the system. And you can even become an expert in the system and not see the problem with it. So that's one example of, again, one of the most esteemed fathers of the Christian church and what he had to say. Now, I gave you another example, which is from a different tradition, and this is the last quote on the sheet. Anyone want to read this one? Maybe someone who hasn't read yet? You didn't read, Barry?
No.
Okay, go for it.
Muslims were legally obliged to wage holy war against Dar al-Harb, the abode of war or non-Muslim realm, as opposed to Dar al-Islam, the abode of Islam, until it ceased to exist or the world came to an end, whichever would be the sooner. It was commonly held that Jesus would return at the end of times to complete the task by breaking the crosses, killing swine, destroying churches and synagogues, and converting al-Khatib, people to book, by persuasion or the sword. Or the Mahdi would see to it that everyone on earth became either a Muslim or a tributary, this being how God would fulfill his promise to make Islam prevail over all religions.
I've always wondered this. When we came back to the text, Reformation, they saw all the wrong things with the Catholic Church, right? Mm-hmm. Why didn't they see the other things, like the holidays and the Sabbath and all that? And my feeling is that, you know, you're talking about being in a system, whether the elders, the elite, of those people themselves could not force themselves to do that because they're so Jewish, but they just knew that the they presented that to the people, that they would be like, oh, that's so Jewish, because they, with that system, it's been so frugal upon them.
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, I think all of us are extremely influenced by the context within which we grow up. Probably no one is able to completely extricate himself or herself from their background. But that said, what?
We're conditioned.
We're conditioned. We are conditioned. We're human beings. We're not, you know, robots or computers. But that said, keep in mind that the Reformation was so far removed from the world of the Bible that I think it would have been almost impossible for it to even occur to anyone to truly reconsider it. Now, it did happen to a certain extent with I unfortunately forget the names at the moment, but there were humanist scholars who studied Hebrew around this time, a little before. What? Yeah, Tyndale was a believer, actually, a strong believer. Not all of the scholars who did this were believers in the text, but there was an attempt to sort of go back to understand the Hebrew original, which led to some radically different conclusions. Now, Tyndale was burned at the stake. And he produced...
Now, the end of the audio recording of Class 1 was also cut off. Most of what we talked about after that point was related to the very end of Chapter 1, which compares the change of paradigm, the change of concepts, the change of mindset that is described in this book to what took place in the Copernican Revolution. And in fact, it's written, this conceptual shift will lead to a transformation of the world which will far exceed that brought by the Copernican Revolution. It will bring this world out of the brokenness, sickness, and death in which it now lies into the wholeness, freedom, and vitality of the realized kingdom of God. It will change the nature of life itself, and that is ever so much more than a succession of new technological ages. Now, we can't reproduce the discussion on that section, which was very good, very interesting, but we do have a special guest to add just a few thoughts on that passage.
In the scenario that God has laid out with Jerusalem at the center of the earth and the world transformed, the world brought from death to life, to try to grasp how significant the difference will be between that time and what we have now. We can just think about the different spheres of life. Think about law. Think about justice, legality. Whereas today, not for everyone, of course, but we have systems that are characterized by the predominant influence of money, power, position, as opposed to what many people would like to see, the abstract or the objective pursuit of justice. In the economic sphere, we have a lot of greed, we have a lot of exploitation, we have the necessity of the warning, let the buyer beware, to think of the difference between what we have now in a system where economically the desire is simply to be fruitful, where the desire is simply to provide and to be a blessing in the earth. Or think about the educational system, where much of it today concerns indoctrination, or simply the remembrance of a certain amount of data, or simply jumping on some bandwagon of the moment, as opposed to coming to understand what is true, coming to see things in the light, including one's own identity, and preparing people to actually be able to think, or the creative arts. Whereas today, much of what's in the world of art, not all of it, of course, includes a desire simply to transgress societal boundaries in order to shock or to present the hopelessness of human existence. We can look forward to a time when creativity will be precisely that. It will involve being creative, taking what we have, taking what's around us, and working with it in such a way that we create something new and beautiful and thought-provoking. You know, in short, as it says in Ecclesiastes, we live in a world now that is characterized by ambition and striving after wind, as opposed to a time, an age in which there will be purposefulness and fruitfulness.